Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. In this very special episode, our 50th, we are delighted to have Todd Capone and we speak about his brand new book, The Transparent Sales Leader.
For me, and for everybody who's listening to this, you know, in the sales world, you've got processes, you've got structure, you've got foundation, you got support. As a sales leader, you got nothing, right? Like I suddenly found, and the analogy I used in the book was that I was kind of like a dog chasing a car down the street. Every morning when I woke up, it was like, whatever direction the car's going, I'm running that way. You know, it could be a deal we're working on or a rep that's leaving, or I got a recruit, or I got a forecast call, or I got a board meeting. It was driving me nuts. And so me being like the way my brain works, I needed something to fall back on. And that's where the structure came from, that I started to chart out like, what are all my roles? And if I'm focused on 20 things, I'm focused on nothing. So like, let's nail these down to what are the core responsibilities that I have that I can start to use as a way to plan, strategize, communicate, up, down, side to side. And when the bullets start flying, I've got that to fall back on all the time. And that's where it started 14 years ago.
Before this, Todd wrote The Transparency Sale, which won the American Book Awards 2019 Sales Book of the Year. He's a speaker and workshop leader as principal of Sales Mellon, LLC. Up until mid-2018, he had spent almost 4 years building the revenue capacity of Chicago's Power Reviews from the ground up as their chief revenue officer, turning it into Illinois' fastest growing tech company. Prior to that, he held sales leadership roles with 3 other tech companies, including ExactTarget, where he helped drive the organization to a successful IPO and a $2.7 billion exit through the acquisition by Salesforce. He's also a former American Business TV Award winner for VP of WW Sales of the Year. Let's go behind the scenes with Todd and take a look at what went into making of the Transparent Sales Leader. Now, on to this exciting episode with Todd Capone.
Todd, welcome back in Bits About Books. I'm so excited to have you back and I'm so excited for your new book.
Well, thank you. It's so great to see you. It's been way too long.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But you have been busy. You have been super busy. And of course, we had the pandemic in between, so it was not easy time for anybody. But I can see that your time has been used so well. My God, this is really, really great. Before we even come to the book, we spoke last when your last book came out, which is The Transparency Sale. Were you thinking about this book when you were writing that one, or was it something which sort of organically came to you?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I'll make it short. I always knew that I wanted to write a book at some point. I just wanted to get my ideas out there. The idea for this book, I actually came up with well before the first book. But there was 2 things that weren't ready. Number one, I didn't know how to write. Number two is it really wasn't that exciting back then because I didn't have the whole circle of the behavioral science around it yet. And like in this new book, I inject a lot from sales history that I didn't know. It's almost like a natural evolution that I came to this point where I was like, you know what? I think we're ready for this one. I've got all the pieces now and I feel fantastic about it that I didn't have, you know, back, it was probably 2015, 2016, where I thought like this would be the great, like a really great framework for people in sales leadership. So it's always been out there. Now it's ready and I'm super proud of it.
Absolutely. I think I saw that post that you made on LinkedIn of the new books arriving, and I was feeling very excited about it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I know you write about how you transitioned into a role that you are not really expecting, and you said to yourself that, am I ready for this? And this framework sort of started coming together. Tell us a bit about how this whole thing happened.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's so relevant right now. You know, back then, so this was 2006 is when it really first started, that I had taken a role running sales operations for a tech company. Sales operations meaning like the processes back then, like enablement was a part of that. But I always knew in my heart that like I wanted to lead, right? Like that was just my passion. And so like there was a day with my CEO where I was in a car with him. And it was day two of my employment in 2006. And we were going to, we had an event and then we were going to dinner afterwards. And it was just me and him in the car. So I was kind of nervous. I was young. And he was like, Todd, why are you here? And I was like, I want to run a sales organization someday. Like that's, I want to come here and I want to learn. Your VP of sales is a guy that I admire. He's going to teach me a lot. And I want to watch this. And then I want to go do it myself. Well, 2 years later, you know, to your point, I got a call that unfortunately that VP of sales was no longer there. And the CEO who had kind of been grooming me told me I was ready. And by being ready, it doesn't mean I had experience as a sales leader because I hadn't. But more importantly, it doesn't mean that I'd ever been trained in sales leadership because I hadn't, right? He just felt like I was ready. And for me, and for everybody who's listening to this, you know, in the sales world, you've got processes, you've got structure, you've got foundation, you got support. As a sales leader, you got nothing, right? Like I suddenly found, and the analogy I used in the book was that I was kind of like a dog chasing a car down the street. Every morning when I woke up, it was like, whatever direction the car's going, I'm running that way. You know, it could be a deal we're working on or a rep that's leaving, or I got a recruit, or I got a forecast call, or I got a board meeting. It was driving me nuts. And so me being like the way my brain works, I needed something to fall back on. And that's where the structure came from, that I started to chart out like, what are all my roles? And if I'm focused on 20 things, I'm focused on nothing. So like, let's nail these down to what are the core responsibilities that I have that I can start to use as a way to plan, strategize, communicate up, down, side to side. And when the bullets start flying, I've got that to fall back on all the time. And that's where it started 14 years ago.
That's so interesting, because what you just said was that as a young salesperson who was bestowed a responsibility, you decided to be proactive instead of being reactive. So
yes.
That's what you are saying, right?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So and proactivity obviously needs planning, needs, I mean, for a lack of a better word, a framework.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing about that is the reason that I'd mentioned, like, I think it's so important now is that, you know, over these last couple of years, we've had this great resignation or whatever you call it, where you've got organizations that their demand for salespeople so far exceeds the supply that they're hiring and hiring and hiring, which means you need more leaders. So you take those people and you promote them to leadership. And the next thing you know, I was teaching a workshop on sales leadership in San Diego a couple of weeks ago. There's 40 sales leaders in the room. You know, for the most part, the majority of them are pretty young. But I just asked, like, how many of you have a process, a framework? How many of you have even been trained in sales leadership before? And out of the 40, not one hand went up. Like, it's zero. And so this problem exacerbates itself by that rapid escalation of the sales profession, that you end up promoting people just assuming they know how to do it. And those sales leaders basically are just taking bits and pieces from leaders that they had reported to in the past. And they become the dog chasing the car down the street too.
I totally agree. In fact, one data point, which I'll just mention, and we don't have to talk about it. It's a typical tenure of a VP of sales today is 18 months.
Yeah.
And I mean, it of course has lot of things going along with that, which means you cannot, as a VP of sales, have any long-term planning, which means you are being by definition being reactive and not being proactive and so on. So, I mean, we have set ourselves up for this.
Right.
But we don't want to talk about that today. That will be another day. but tell me, as you started looking at this this scenario that you need a framework, obviously this 5 F's didn't come about on their own.
It
didn't come to you together, but you would have done, I mean, I don't know, it might have, but I'm just saying, curious, how did this come about?
Well, yeah, I mean, so why don't, for everybody, I'll just list off the five so that people have context to what we're talking about. So I had determined that, like, I had five core responsibilities, that every single activity and priority that I could possibly have falls into one of the five. And so the first one is focus, meaning that I have a responsibility to myself and my team and our whole organization to make sure that we are focused on the right opportunities in the right places at the right time with the right people and the right prerequisites, right? So the what I call firmographics, which are like, what are the right companies we need to be focused on? And then demographics, what are the right individuals within those, the levels, the titles, the roles and responsibilities? And then prerequisites, meaning like, what do they have to have? Like, where do we fit in there? So establish, but ongoing, like one of my philosophies was always in every leadership role, no science projects, right? Like that we know where we're good, and it's my responsibility to make sure that we're optimizing our most precious asset that we all have as salespeople and leaders, and that's our time. Mm-hmm. So focus is the first F. The second F then is, once you have that focus established, you build a field organization to support that focus. So what team has taken the field, the individuals, their responsibilities, experience, where they're located, how much you pay them, and also the tools and the resources that are going to support them. That's all in field. And you can't do it the opposite way, right? Like, and many organizations do that. They hire best candidates and then they're like, you're going to focus on that. Well, that's not what I'm good at. So like, make sure that you do it in the right order. The third F is the fundamentals. You as a leader have a initial and ongoing responsibility to make sure your team is doing the right things right consistently. They're prospecting, positioning, messaging, presenting, negotiating, handoffs, client success, all of those pieces. Those three are like the core. The fourth one, of course, is the forecast, right? You have a responsibility to predict the future. And within that forecast includes the metrics by which you do such things, right? Like, what are the, when we say key performance indicators, if you've got 30 of them, they're not key, right? So like, what are the key performance indicators that directly translate to your results and how do you use them? And then the fifth F, which I believe is arguably the most important and makes up about half of the book. It's the real nerdy behavioral science piece. It's fun, meaning it's our responsibility to create an environment where our team wants to show up every day, wants to do their best, wants to stay and wants to become advocates. And that's meaning, how do you create a culture of what I call intrinsic inspiration, meaning that they're intrinsically inspired to do their best. And the quote that I say at the beginning of that part is, your reps are coin operated if you're doing it wrong. That if we create an environment where variable compensation is the reward for doing work we love to do versus the motivator, that's when everybody wins. And so the five F's is, establish your focus, build a field to support it, make sure they're doing the fundamentals right, get really good at forecasting, and then create a fun environment chock full of intrinsic inspiration.
Yeah, there is so much there to unpack, and we'll get there. But a little bit on the background, how did you sort of codify this? How long did it take, or were some pieces there, but not sort of articulated in the way you have articulated in the book? I mean, you must be doing it, but you are not doing it as a part of a framework, but you're doing it right. So bit on that. Let's talk about that.
It's a good question. I don't even know where it started. I think it was, the question that all sales leaders get asked, and even reps get asked from other sales leaders and other reps, is, hey, you know what? I need to put together a 30, 60, 90 day plan. What should that look like? And then there's all these frameworks and structures and templates that you can find all over the place. And so I started there, but I found that it became hard for me to make it repeatable, shareable. The five F's became the structure by which I did even my one-on-ones with my CEO and my direct reports. It became the agenda for my board meetings. Like, I'd go into a board meetings and they're like, hey, like, Todd, what's going on? I'm like, I'm going to take you through a breakdown of how we're doing via these five F's. Hmm. And so that's kind of where it morphed, is like, I needed to make it memorable. Hmm. And that there's a story in the book that I tell, that I'm not sure if you got to yet, but if you don't mind, I'll tell the story
quickly. Yeah, yeah, please, please go ahead.
So it was like 2009, we took a round of funding. Hmm. Now for all you leaders, if you take a round of funding, my best advice for you is make sure you hit that first quarter. Hmm. You don't want to miss that one. Well, this guy did. We did like 92% of our first quarter after a fundraise. And our chairman, who was, you know, seated on the board of one of the large VCs in the Valley, was none too happy about it. And so 2 days after the quarter ends, my CEO calls and is like, Todd, they want to meet with you. So get on a plane. So I live in Chicago. They're like, get on a plane, come out to the Valley, Sand Hill Road. And they're bringing in a forensic sales expert to basically beat you up all over the room for 3.5 hours and make sure that you're bulletproof. And at first I was afraid, like nervous, like, oh my goodness. But I ended up just going five F's, right? And so I got out there, we get in this room. This guy was brilliant. Like the guy was really, really good. But I got to control the whole message. And my point being is that when the bullets start flying, you've got that to fall back on. Hmm. You prove to anybody that, like, hey, this is the way that I think about leadership and my role and responsibility. Let's break down each one of these five, and I'll tell you what my strategy and plan is, and we can dig through it, and I would love your advice on it. Hmm. At the end of that 3.5 hours, the good news for me and the bad news for my CEO was this guy looked me in the eyes and was like, Todd, you are world class. And I'm like, you know, I was just a kid. I wasn't world class. Hmm. But I do think that having a structure and a framework put me ahead of 99% of anybody else in the role. Hmm. And like when I say the bad news for my CEO is I remember that chairman like looking at me, or I'm sorry, he was looking at the CEO and he said like this, and for anybody who's watching the video of this, he's looking at the CEO and he's like, Todd, meet us in the lobby in 15 minutes. And so I got up and leave and I left the room with the CEO. And I think they just like, they blamed him for everything. But the point being that that was kind of where I was trying to go with this. And I don't remember what those initial pieces were, but I was like, it's got to be memorable. And to the point where even in my last role, the board, like I would start, they would go like, hey, Todd, what's the sales update? And I'm like, what do you think? And they're like, is it the five F's? I'm like, of course it's the five F's. Like they came to know that I had my stuff together and that that was going to be the framework, and it gave them a ton of confidence too.
This is great. Just to touch upon the fun thing, which you did mention as the most important bit of, I'm sure none is more important than the other, but I do believe that in some strange way, you are touching upon very core issues that is out there and we are not talking enough in terms of what's wrong with sales. One was the tenure bit that we just spoke about. Fun also basically addresses this whole culture of quota and incentivization, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think there is something fundamentally not working there. Right. Otherwise, with incentive, everybody would have been making their quota. All companies would have been making quota and so on. So tell me, I know you're a big sales history nerd, and I love the stuff that you post, and I wonder, where do you find time and actually those resources to find those things? Where do you go?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I had a book that I'd found in somebody's library. It was from 1954 on sales. And I was like, wow, this is fast. This was like 5 years ago. It was fascinating. So much of it, you could literally plug paragraphs and drop it in LinkedIn today as today, and people would be like, that's brilliant. But I read it. I was like, this is really amazing. And then there was some stuff in it that was crazy, like the door-to-door approaches. I was like, wow, that's weird. But the book kept referencing older books. So I kept digging. I'd go to like abebooks.com and eBay and see which ones I could get. And I found a couple. I kept going back. I managed to find a library of digital, like scanned books from the late 1800s and early 1900s and magazines. I bought all those. And then there was a couple that I couldn't get, but I called the Library of Congress here in the US. Mm-hmm. And I found somebody who apparently is bored and loves helping people find stuff. Mm-hmm. And that this lady, I was like I want it. There's a book from 1869 that's identified as the first sales book of all time. And like, I can't remember the name of it, but I was like, I can't find it. What is it? This woman did her research, found it, and then found a scanned version of it and just sent it to me. So like, wow. I've got the first book, according to the Library of Congress, that is labeled as a sales book of all time. And so when you say find time, I always joke, like when cool people are doing cool things on the weekends, I'm sitting back with like a 1907 salesmanship book. You know, like that's, I find it fascinating. And there's so much wisdom in that. And yeah. One last point. Huh. For everybody that, you know, sometimes you'll see on LinkedIn or someplace else, like the top 100 sales books of all time. And I was honored to be one of those in one of those lists, but I was also angry. And here's why. Almost every book, it was like 87 of the top 100 books, according to this list, were in the last 10 years. And I'm like, no, the writers, the way they wrote, the way that they formulated opinions and structure, the words they use, the greatest sales books of all time are 100 years old, all of them. Like I'm honored. My book is not one of the top 100 books of all time.
Awesome. let's talk about the behavioral science bit, because I know that you love that stuff.
Yes.
And I also know that it is not without reason you brought it in. You could have pretty much ended the book after chapter 7, theoretically.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have expanded that or whatever, but you could have had the book done at that point. But you decided to actually create an entire part with 6 more chapters on the behavioral bit, and which is so critical, obviously, because we are all torn between this whole thing, being human, not being human, being tech, non-tech. I mean, it's like all over the place, right? Especially if you're a new, I'm actually talking to some leaders who are basically dealing with SDRs, because that's one area of interest for me. I'm doing some research, and you can see the amount of confusion out there. It's not funny.
So
let's dig into this part 2 of the book. It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
It's so interesting to me that neuroscientists have put their finger on what really drives us, right? And there's different categories of it. And so I've read like a bunch of different versions of that. And so I decided, being the nerd that I am, that I wanted to put together a structure that was really specific to the intrinsic inspiration of salespeople. Like, what are the pieces that truly drive us?
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful, and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it. So let's dig into this part 2 of the book.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me that neuroscientists have put their finger on what really drives us, right? And there's different categories of it. And so I've read like a bunch of different versions of that. And so I decided, being the nerd that I am, that I wanted to put together a structure that was really specific to the intrinsic inspiration of salespeople. Like, what are the pieces that truly drive us beyond the paycheck, right? And so you're talking about the acronyms. It so happens that all 6 of those chapters make up the word praise. But there's 6 things that drive us as human beings to show up, do our best, stay, and advocate. And to rattle those 6 off real quick, the first one is predictability. Like, we do our best. We sleep best at night when we know what we're getting into the next morning. We are at our peak in creativity, in performance, in IQ, when there's certainty. Right. And that speaks to like uncertainty, how that literally does the opposite. It's a crazy maker for the brain. So predictability is number 1. Number 2 is we do our best work when there's recognition available, right? Recognition for our efforts, feedback, validation, status, right? We do great when we give it a title that our buddies think is cool, right? So recognition is number two. Number three is aim, meaning does my work matter beyond my forecast? What is the aim, the mission, the purpose, the impact that my work does on my company, on my manager, on my customers, and on their customers? And that's an important thing. Like, do we know how what we're selling impacts our customers' customers? And I think like that's something we could dig into because I think it's an overlooked piece. The I is independence. We do our best work when we're given a layer of independence, autonomy, when we're trusted, we're given the resources to do our best work without somebody micromanaging us right over our shoulder. The next one is S, right? And it's that whole science around security and feeling of safety and being a part of a pack. So that fifth one is security, which is, do I feel like somebody's got my back? Do I feel a part of a pack, a part of a team, a part of a family? Do I have relations with other people? Do I have a best friend at work? Like we do our best work when we're a part of a pack. And then the E has some to do with the compensation, right? But it's equitability, meaning is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the rewards that I get for my efforts worth what I get back? Not only in terms of how I feel is fair, but fair and void of politics from other people. When you balance that praise, so I had a version of that written on my screen as a CRO that like, as I was thinking about the way that I was managing my team and as they would come in and they're like, hey, I'm leaving, really. And so I would interview them through the lens of praise because that's how we get better. And clearly something was missing and that's a coaching opportunity too. So that praise piece I think is so important, especially now, you know, pre this call, we had the great resignation.
Yeah.
From a sales history perspective, that there could be a great purge coming if history repeats itself and we continue to step on the same rake over and over again like we do. Mm. And it means we need to optimize that piece.
Absolutely. Before you elaborate on chapter 10, which is AIM, I know you want to talk about it a bit more. I have a quick question. Where does self-motivation fit into this? Because that's also part of you being inspired in doing what you are doing, right?
Right. Yes.
So I just wanted to know, does it figure here or is it something you deliberately chose to leave out?
Well, we're self-motivated when the elements of praise are balanced, right? So like we quickly lose our engagement and our self-motivation when we feel like the juice isn't worth the squeeze, right? And so that means that optimizing intrinsic inspiration is kind of this, like intrinsic inspiration is another word for self-motivation. Like if we really are netting it out,
yeah.
It's just a different, like, you know, Todd Capone way of saying it. It's like intrinsic inspiration, meaning like extrinsic means I need rewards and dollars. Intrinsic means I wake up in the morning, I can't wait to get after it. Right. And the reason that happens is because I've got predictability. I'm being recognized. There's an aim to my work. I've got some independence. I feel secure and it's equitable. Like I feel like the juice is worth the squeeze. So that's really where it all comes from.
Yeah. I think I get it. I get the context and I think that's great. So coming back to AIM, you wanted to talk a bit more about that chapter because that's a critical, very critical piece of what you just explained.
So it was like, if you look at the period from when COVID started to now, it's a case study in the behavioral science of self-motivation and intrinsic inspiration, right? That like we went through this period where everybody was sent home and managers lost their ability to predict, right? That first one. And so they overcompensated on that with daily check-ins in the morning and the afternoon. What are you going to work on today? How did you do? And then they quickly realized that security piece was missing, that their teams felt like they were all alone and they weren't building familial type relationships. So we started doing Zoom happy hours and like overcompensating on that, right? We got to a point where the physical cost of changing jobs was practically gone, right? Because you didn't have to change commutes. You get a new laptop and maybe somebody sends you some logoed socks. And so no physical cost. And no emotional cost to change jobs, meaning I don't really have a best friend here. I've never met any of you people I work with in like, you know, I never actually shook hands with you, never actually gone to a real happy hour with you. So our cost of changing jobs was zero. You match that up with the incredible demand and low supply for salespeople, and they're going to leave. They're going to chase money. They're going to chase that next thing. And so we saw all of that happening over and over again. And you see companies like, we're doing happy hour. Like, you know what's missing? The unique glue that your company has is the impact and aim and mission and purpose of your organization. And if you can really highlight that and make sure that all your reps know it, that their work matters beyond your forecast, matters beyond their quota, matters even beyond their paycheck, that is when companies find that they can compete. They can keep talent because everybody feels bound by a mission, a purpose, an aim, an impact. You know, like, for example, and one of the examples I write about in the book is a story I'd read in another book, but I thought it was fascinating. That there was a medical device company, and you know they've got, I don't think I wrote about this specific one. I found another story that's similar to it, but the medical device company, they had a bunch of people that would sit in a lab all day and just stack pieces, like they were assembling medical devices all day long. Sounds like totally painfully boring, right? Yet they had almost zero turnover and their productivity was huge. Why? Because every couple of weeks, they would bring somebody in who's wearing that medical device for a lunch and learn. And that individual would get up there and be like, hey, listen, if you didn't stack those screws like that, I wouldn't be here. And like their kids would run in, I wouldn't have a mom here. Like, they'd go through that whole thing. And everybody would start crying and they couldn't wait to get back to work. That's the missing thing. And it doesn't have to be that cheesy. But like my last role, I was the chief revenue officer of a ratings and reviews company. Who cares? You know who cares? Our customer's customer, who's got not a whole lot of money to spend and is trying to make really smart decisions. And the information we were elevating and making available to them was helping them make really smart decisions that were impacting their home lives. And my team, it wasn't even a conscious thing. My team was really rallied by that. They loved making that kind of impact. And you know, during my tenure at Power Reviews, there was a 18-month period where our turnover, voluntary turnover, was 2%. That was unheard of. But I think it was because we were all bound by our aim and our mission and our purpose, which was our customers' customers. Like, for anybody listening to this, figure that out, right? Go talk to your customers and go, why does what you sell matter to your customers? And find those threads and use those to keep your team inspired by what you do. You're not just selling stuff. You're selling an outcome to somebody at the back end of that. And if you don't know what that is, turnover could stay high.
This is so important, because I was literally about to ask you a question, which I'm not going to ask now, is if you're in a quote-unquote commodity business, which most of us are, I mean, none of us are selling anything very unique. Most of us are not selling anything very unique, and that makes it very hard to define this. But the moment you move the lens to a customer success or your customer's customer success, whatever that path is, then your stories are unique. It doesn't matter whether you're selling the same thing. So I think this is a very, very, very powerful thought. This is a good takeaway from this chat, I think, for anybody, because they can really, really see value in what they're doing. I think that's the most critical part, right? Most of us are not sure that what we do really matter.
Exactly. And most leaders are not making sure that their team is aware of that, right? That they're so focused on their quota and their forecast that they can pick up and go anywhere and experience that same thing. And when there's low physical and low emotional cost of changing jobs, the triggers by which one of your reps or a team member decides to take a recruiter call or go poke around is, you just raised my quota. My territory just got smaller. Don't really like the look of my pipeline. I was at a party and a buddy of mine is at another company making a ton of money and having a blast and they're hiring. Those triggers are tiny. And unless there's something unique and your aim is unique to your company, and if nobody knows what it is, then what's to keep them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That moves us to part three of myths and the application. So let's touch upon that. What are the myths that you talk about here, Todd?
There's a bunch. There's so much in the book that's counterintuitive. Like, as you dig into it, you're going to see I try to throw out the traditional ways of thinking about our forecasting. And I use sales history pretty emphatically in that one. We can talk about that if you'd like. It's this sure. idea, and that one comes right out of sales history. But the myths, you know, things like, you can self-motivate somebody through fear, right? Like if you're in a boat and there's a shark coming after you, you're pretty motivated, right? Yeah. But that's not sustainable. Like, I mean, there's some things in that myths thing that just talk to this idea that some of the traditional means by which, like us old guys, were brought up being led by others, they turn out to do the opposite. But from a forecasting perspective, I'll bring up one. I believe, and I began to believe this about 10 years ago, that the word commit is a dirty word. And what I mean by that is, you know, even when I joined that company in 2006, day one during that sales kickoff, all the reps were required to be brought into a room. And so we're all in this room and they all had to give their quarter commits. Like, what dollar amount are you advocating? Like, what are you committing to for the quarter? And if you really look at the behavioral science of that, it literally does the opposite of every outcome that you're looking for. It encourages lying. Because the reps that are like that are not comfortable with their pipeline are going to overcommit. The reps that have huge pipelines are going to undercommit, and everybody is going to commit their number for the quarter, right? Like, that's number one. But number two is that type of environment means that when one of your deals that you've committed goes awry, guess who the last person they're going to come to is when that deal is off the rails versus the person you want them to come to? That's your leader, yeah. right? That if I, and they're going to try to find a way to either whirl their way out of it or blame the customer. And you want to create environments where it's known that even a deal that a customer has said yes to might only close 50 to 75% of the time, right? True. That we need to create environments. And so one of the counterintuitive things that I talk about a lot in that in the forecast chapter specifically, is we used to embrace losing. And I know that sounds crazy, but there was even one time we did a champagne toast for a rep that lost a deal. Now, why would we do that? Like, that's crazy. Well, number one is they're already getting hit in the pocket. Right? They're already suffering from it. So let's celebrate the effort and let's celebrate the lessons that can be learned from that. Because like the mistake would be to keep losing over and over again and create an environment where if it was the rep's fault, they're proud to own it, right? Like, hey, I missed this. I screwed this up. I messaged this wrong. Or to illuminate what it is it about this deal that's like the last three that we've lost that will help all the rest of the reps point in the right direction. Because if you've got a commit environment, it's always the customer's fault. Your pipeline ends up getting really inaccurate quickly because your reps will either push out the close date, like, hey, what happened to that deal? It's going to be next year. Or it suddenly moves out of qualified state and disappears and nobody knows about it. Your biggest mistake you can make is not learning from the losses. And if you as a leader don't create the environment where that's embraced, how do you do it?
Absolutely. I totally agree. And it's reminding me of this book by Andrea Walsh. She was on our show a few weeks back and she talks about, she wrote this book called Go for No, right?
So
you know about that. So
well, yeah, I mean, my first book, The Transparency Sale, really digs into that too. It's right. Imperfection, lead with transparency. And I mean, that's why negative reviews on a website right under a product
right.
help it sell more. Is like, hey, this is the stuff you might not like. And if you're cool with that, here's what you're going to love. Yeah. But if you're not cool with that, it's better to know now versus 3 months from now when I just burned a bunch of my precious inventory of time.
Right, right. You, before we wrap up, you wanted to talk about the sales history bit. You had some interesting bits to share.
I wanted to just point a couple of things out. Like when we talked about sales history, there's some things that they did brilliantly, and there's some things that they did that were pretty wacky. But one of the brilliant things is when I read books from 1900 to 1930, you know what they never talk about in any of them is an inability to forecast. Here's why. I don't know if you ever seen the movie Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah.
Remember that movie? It's like, and Alec Baldwin's got a scene in it that is abusive. It, like, you'll cry yourself to sleep watching it. But he goes through this thing called AIDA, right? And it's attention, desire, or I'm sorry, AIDA. It's attention, interest, desire, action. Hmm. Now, he actually got that right. And here's why. In 1898, Elias St. Elmo Lewis theorized that every buyer goes through four stages on their purchasing journey, right? AIDA. It's attention, it was interest, it was desire, and then it was action. And that became the method by which every single sales process and sales forecasting methodology was born. In every book, and I mean, there's in Norris Briscoe, Norval Hawkins, Arthur Dunn. I mean, there's tons of books back then that all say, hey, every sales philosopher worth their salt knows it's AIDA. Hmm. And that was the end of it. Now, what happened? Well, in the 1950s, we came up with seller-focused stages, processes, and forecasting methodology based on where the seller is, right? And it started with IBM when they're selling multi-million dollar machines. They had to be selfish. But other companies looked at that and they're like, IBM, they're doing well. We should do what they're doing. And then all of a sudden, you know, Siebel, Salesforce, every CRM stage that comes out of the box of every CRM is discovery, qualification, demo, proposal, close, like it's all seller focused. So all of the endorphins that salespeople, we can pretend to be buyer focused all day long. But when all of the endorphins and the milestones that salespeople need to achieve to be able to achieve their deal close and they're all seller focused. That, I believe, was the beginnings of how we messed up forecasting. Now, at Power Reviews, I had recognized this, and like I'm not some genius, like, oh, look at me. But we did take our stages and layered over the top the buyer behavior, and it wasn't AIDA. We used why change, why you, why now. And we layered those over the top, and then we taught all of our reps to recognize the signs of buyer behavior. We then slotted our forecast based on those, and our forecast became infinitely more accurate overnight, right? Like we were over a six-quarter period. I was within 3.5% of our 90-day forecast 6 quarters in a row. And and that's I really attribute that to we need to change the lens by which we think about deal progress and forecasting to be through the lens of the buyer's eyes and not what the seller's doing. And so that's one of those counterintuitive things that I think is a huge opportunity, and it's not that hard to implement.
Absolutely.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Todd, this is great, and I loved chatting with you as usual. And I do look for, you know, you mentioned that at least two topics we mentioned while we chatted today that we should dig into them later. I know you will be very busy next couple of months promoting your book, so I'll let you be. But maybe next quarter I'm going to circle back and you know, try to get some time with you and we can talk about those.
Oh, God, there's like 100 things. And I always really have a blast talking to you. So anytime, I would love to.
Todd, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, Subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from. And give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.